Welcome back to the Technology Whisperers. It has been a hot minute since my illustrious co-host Alistair Ross and I were recording an episode, and we are launching season two. This will be episode one of season two. Alistair, welcome back to the microphone.
Hey, it's great. It's great to be here, Sean. Absolutely fantastic. You know, when you say like season two, kind of sounds like we're talking about episodes of Friends or something like that, you know, that, like or that we had the TV.
Or that we had it planned. Like we had these seasons laid out. And let's touch on that for a second. Look, Alistair and I, we don't wing it, but we do allow the technologies that are we allow the technologies of the moment that are on the minds of, you know, the next CEO, the next CIO. We make sure that we cover those rather than trying to lay out what we think the technology. I mean, Alistair and I both have ideas about what the technology roadmap is going to be for the next 3 years to 5 years, but we also know that it's going to pivot. And so this gives us the ability to flex a little bit in what we do. So we are going to go a little bit around. But Alistair, over to you.
Oh, thanks, Sean. Look, yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you all again here on the Technology Whisperers. And it feels really strange to be back in the booth again recording, because so much of both of our lives has really changed in such a short space of time. Now, I think the last time we actually recorded an episode was pretty much around a year ago. Is that about right, Sean?
It was about 9 months. We were, in fact, the company was still Servian was sponsoring us at that time.
That's right.
Even though the Cognizant purchase of Servian had gone through, but we were still, this podcast was still sponsored by Servian.
Yeah. So both of us, both Sean and I, have since moved on from the Servian. Well, it was called Servian. The company that was sponsoring this podcast was Servian. They were bought out by a global company called Cognizant. And shortly after that, both Sean and I left, not because of the same reason, we just left around the same sort of time. And we started doing different things. So I decided that I was going to really put my full intent off the cybersecurity world. So I was the director of cybersecurity at Servian Cognizant. And I thought, you know what? I should be doing this myself. And so I decided to quit, throw everything away, no salary, nobody holding me back, just to go ahead and start my own business. So that's exactly what I did, Sean.
All kidding aside, Alistair is such an exceptional security leader and leader in this space. I think your company's going to shine. I think it's going to turn out really well.
Sean, you're going to make me blush, and I don't think I've ever blushed before. So either that or it might be the heating I've got on here in the studio. But
it is a little bit chilly in Wellington.
It's not the warmest. I mean, I left Scotland for a reason, Sean, and I can tell you what, this is not it. But yeah, so I started my own business. It's called Revolution InfoSec. You can head over to the website. It is live, but we'll put a link.
We'll put a link in to the website as well as your contact details, Revolution InfoSec, and the LinkedIn page as well.
Awesome. Yes. I can't wait for that. So yeah, so it's all kicking off now. And you know, if you guys need any sort of risk assessments, any governance stuff, any cybersecurity penetration testing and all that sort of good stuff, then absolutely hit me up. But this is not to plug my own stuff. This is all about what technology is all about for today and the future. So Sean, obviously I made a move, but you made a move around the same sort of time. Now, what was it that you went into?
Well, it's a good question, Alistair. And you know, time-wise, it was really kind of weird because I think I came to you and said, hey, I think I've got a job offer. And you went, yeah, I think I'm going to start my own business. And literally, unbeknownst to either one of us, this was bubbling in the background and it came up. On that note, Alistair and I are now taking this podcast under our own I mean, his company, that I'm sure there will be some funding from his company is because of his time, but we're really taking this on our own wallets. And so Servian's no longer sponsoring us. Cognizant has moved on, but we would be open to, if someone wanted to reach out, if someone wanted to sponsor or something, we would be open to that. Either way, we're going to keep going.
Yeah.
But around that same time, so I was running the AI practice for Cognizant in New Zealand. And to be clear, since 2013, slightly before 2013, I've done nothing but consulting work. So I've worked for consulting companies, IBM, Voco Consulting, Liquid IT, and then Servian, Cognizant. And I have now taken on a solution architecture role leading the data and AI practice within Woolworths New Zealand. The big announcement being that Countdown is now rebranding as Woolworths New Zealand. And we won't talk about that. That's a whole nother conversation. But I'm now helping Woolworths New Zealand lay out how they're going to use AI to completely transform not only the way their customers interact with them, but the way their team works and how they do what it is they're doing. Mm. So I have a huge task in front of me, and I'm working for a company again for the first time in over 10 years, and it feels really weird.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the great thing about, you know, major shift changes, you know. But, you know, getting back to AI and the fact that you've kind of been in this AI bubble, right? So before you did AI, you were heavy into the sort of networking and security and systems sorts of side of things. But then over the last, 10 years or something, you've been into AI and been learning and all that sort of stuff. Sean, it's fair to say that you got into AI before AI was cool.
Well, I've had some people have commented on that. I mean, look, you were in security, you were in networking security around the 90s, early 2000s, the same as I was. And we, on the networking side, we were trying to automate stuff. Set AI aside for a second. We were trying to automate stuff on the network in such a way that we could, an event would occur, it would help us do a root cause analysis of the event, and it would automatically do something to fix that event. So, I mean, we've been playing around with this idea of enterprise AI since the 2000s. The problem is that we didn't have the data. We didn't have access to compute the way you have access to power. Compute was, I need a server. So I go spend of $250,000 to buy a server. And 3 months later, I go, oh, I couldn't do it.
It was pretty expensive.
Yeah, nobody was going to sign off on that. So we needed the data. So we needed the internet, and we needed cloud, which would give us, you know, ready access to compute that we could turn on and off as we needed it. And then about 6 years ago, I saw that shift where actually you could do AI. And you're right, Alistair. I've been probably doing consulting work on AI, among other things, for about the last 6 or 7 years, rolling out the first digital human at a New Zealand government ministry with Ella at New Zealand Police.
Well, I thought you were going to talk about one of our MPs there.
No. Yeah. Natural language processing assessment, enterprise development. But we've had the big shift was about October, November of last year. Now, I've been a beta user of OpenAI for almost 3 years now. GPT-2, GPT-3, I was a beta user for ChatGPT 2 months before it came out. And then we had this iPhone moment in October, November, where they had 2 million subscribers in the first week.
Mm. I mean, 2 million seems like nothing now compared to where it is.
Yeah.
And everybody knows that the reason I kind of said, hey, you were involved with AI before AI was cool, is because, you know, AI, especially in the way it's known right now, was not a wholesale type of thing. It wasn't really understood by the masses. You know, before there were smartphones, people said, oh, I've got a mobile phone. And then there were smartphones and everybody, you know, went to buy the iPhone, right? Yeah. We're talking about the same kind of emphasis here when we're talking about pre-OpenAI ChatGPT and what happened after November 2022. Really, that is it. It's like the dawn of the AI age. Well,
Well, and it's interesting because the technology that delivered ChatGPT was in existence before October. Hmm. What OpenAI did right was they made it easily usable. The user interface for the vast majority of people was just really easy for them to use, and they could actually interact with it, and they got good outcomes from it. And don't get me wrong, the large language model that sat behind it with GPT 3.5 was trained well enough that it actually meant something when you got a response to it. But that interface and the way that they opened it up for people to just come in and use it was why we had that iPhone moment for them.
Yeah, it really was. So, I mean, I guess today, to start off with our first sort of topics, Sean and I went to the whiteboard and just started writing down topics of anything. You know, that's what the whole point of the Technology Whisperers is. I guess if we should probably go back to that. Why do we do this Technology Whisperers thing, right? And Sean, the whole idea of this podcast is really to demystify the technology that's out there. And whatever that technology might be,
that's right.
I was actually listening back to some of the old podcasts that we did last year. One of them was about zero trust in cybersecurity and why a CIO or a CTO or a CEO even should actually care about what this very techie sounding thing is and why that might affect their organization. So basically all that we're doing is doing that same thing for each one of these topics.
That's right.
And sometimes we'll expand on it, we'll get a bit more in depth, but we always want to make sure that we talk at a sort of base level to make sure that everybody listening, no matter what level of technical capability you might have, what the technology means and how it affects you and your business or your organization.
Yeah.
That's really the crux of what this Technology Whisperers podcast is all about. And so when Sean and I were putting together the topics for today's show, both of us subconsciously, without each other knowing about it, we put down all the tasks on a Trello board. And it just so happened that both of us put down pretty much everything about generative AI. So today's, I guess most of it is kind of like news, because there's a heck of a lot of news that's happened since October last year.
Yeah.
And obviously our last podcast was, like you said, I think it was like, you know, August, September time last year.
Yeah, that sounds right.
There was no ChatGPT, not publicly anyway.
Not production. Yeah, you couldn't get to it. Yeah.
So I think what we're going to have to do is play a bit of catch up. So first things first, Sean, you're going to actually do a separate Technology Whisperers podcast, and that's coming real soon, about generative AI, aren't you?
Yeah, we're gonna do a little bit of a deep dive on generative AI, and deep being a demystification deep dive. I'm gonna use this term several times, iPhone. I remember when the iPhone came out in 2007. We had executives that showed up at the office and said, "Hey, I want this on the corporate network." And we said, "No, you have a BlackBerry. And we're not ready for that iPhone yet. So maybe in a couple of years." And it took us about 3 years. Well, you need to know a little bit about generative AI before you release it on your enterprise. And you need to be planning for that. So we're going to talk a little bit about it. We're going to go into strategy and how you can make it work and how you can get, you know, really good outcomes from it. And I mean really good outcomes. Some of the coders, some of the executives, some of the marketing people and salespeople that I've talked with recently they're stunned. It's taking a 2-hour work load down to 15 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of it. So, and that's the good thing. I mean, I won't dwell on this too much because I think this is a whole topic for that special edition of the podcast. But, you know, basically, where everything, you know, great comes along, like you said about your iPhone there, you know, you've got this new technology, everybody wants to have it. It goes into the network, sometimes undercover, but you know, there's all this great stuff, but there's always this sort of fear aspect to it as well. And, you know, applying the technology in a safe way, in a consistent way, is really important to your organization. And in fact, you know, here in New Zealand, there hasn't been that much legislation or anything about it yet, but I dare say that will happen. And it has been spotty. So, for example, in MB, I think it is, I think it was back as early as sort of March or April, they decided to put the foot down early and say, "Hey guys, we're not actually allowing ChatGPT into the organization there. And other government departments haven't actually followed suit. So it'd be interesting to see how this all shakes out there. But that's just one example of how it's going.
It's interesting because several companies have tried to take that approach. I mean, Samsung had that huge internal communications leak because one of the employees was using ChatGPT to write emails, and a whole bunch of internal documents got into ChatGPT. Several other very large corporations have basically said, no, you can't use it. The problem is that they might be able to block OpenAI's ChatGPT, but then they can't block Bard, Google's Bard, and Microsoft's Bing, and someone can spin up their own Llama and run their own large language model. It's a target that if their stance to it is that, we're just going to block everybody in the company from using it, it's just going to push it into shadow IT.
Exactly.
And then you get bad outcome. You get bad outcomes.
Yeah. So there has to be a more constructive way of dealing with this. But I mean, back in March or whenever it was that MB decided to block it, of course, things were a little bit more simplistic then, and AI has spread virally since then. Yeah. So I think, look, unapologetically, the rest of this podcast is going to mainly feature around advancements and the news, the current news in AI in the marketplace, really. And I guess that's quite handy from a perspective of keeping you up to date with what's going on in this highly important aspect of IT, because
it's really fast moving.
And I think that's really important to cover this, because this will, and I'm I had a different take on AI to you, Sean. Obviously, you'd kind of gone full hog into AI, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, a long time ago, because you saw a future that I couldn't have seen. But then, and so I have to be honest with you, right up until about, mid last year or even later, AI was just kind of something that was like, oh yeah, AI is there and it's got its particular applications here and particular applications there. And I thought some areas of it were cool and were helpful. But there wasn't a wholesale AI thing out there that I could say, hey, this is transformative. This is really going to change the landscape for our world. Now, if you think back to the year 1977, right? 1977. So a lot of us weren't alive then. But if we think about 1977, what's special about that year? Well, the microchip had been invented. It'd been invented around 1972, I think, by Intel, the 4004. And there was iterations from that 4-bit CPU into 8-bit CPU. And then eventually we got this 8080 CPU and the Z80 CPU and all the rest. And then what happened almost overnight in 1977, three companies came along. One of them was Apple, one of them was Tandy, and another one was Commodore, I think it was. Correct me if I'm wrong. But three companies came along almost overnight and created a computer system that sat on your desktop. Now, everything else before that time, that year, that one year, was in a server room. It was a big hulking thing. It would take rooms up of buildings, big commercial stuff. So the ability to use computing kind of wherever you were was not available. So what happened almost overnight is that we went from an industrial revolution into an information revolution in the about the late 70s and early 80s. And then IBM came along in 1981, and then the IBM PC came along, and then everything else was history after that, right? And that was 3 or 4 years. But we had this revolution that really normalized computation, and people were really worried back then that they would all lose their jobs. And that was a scary time for a lot of people, because they saw robots going in to build cars and in factories and all that sort of stuff. We must remember that whilst some people did lose their jobs, they were re-put into new jobs and upskilled in other areas, and things were all right in the end. So we went from that age, which is the information age, and we're going into something now that I believe is called the knowledge age. And it's where AI augments our capabilities, our brains, with this level of automation that really is unlike anything we've ever seen before.
Well, It gives us the promise. So the promise of computers was is that it was going to reduce our workload and allow us to do more. But anybody that has worked on computers for the last 20, 30 years knows that we didn't see that happen. Every time, you know, some new system came out that was supposed to make it easier for us to do something, it became managing that system or working in that system actually was more complicated. I mean, so writing a letter and sticking an envelope and putting it in the mail, although slow, it's fairly easy to do. Anybody that's tried to talk to their grandparents about writing an email and getting the email address right and getting the subject right and sending that email off knows that it's anything but simple to just write a letter in email form. So literally most of the technology revolution that we've seen, although it has increased our productivity, it hasn't reduced the amount of work we have to do. And I think you're right, because I think this knowledge age is going to fundamentally change that, where it's the technology process is handled by an AI system, and we have the knowledge to drive how that AI system does what it does.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, that's why there's so much fear. Again, we saw that fear segment at the beginning of the information age. Oh, it's gonna take us all out of jobs. It's gonna change the way that we work. All of that. Okay, it did have an upset, but then, you know, it worked out all just well. I think the same is going to be said for AI. But it's a huge disruptor, and it is really going to change the way that we work in everything we do. If you think about a desk now in an office, you can't imagine a desk in an office without a computer on it. Well, fast forward a couple of years, you will not imagine some form of AI in the way that you work and live. It's just not going to be the case. It's going to be everywhere. And that's, you know, we've opened Pandora's box. You know, you can't undo this.
And let's underline this a little bit. The AI systems are not going to come and take people's jobs. But people that know how to use AI to do things and to do them better and faster and at a greater productivity level are going to replace those people that don't want to use AI or don't want to learn how to use AI. And we had a little bit of this in the internet revolution. And Amazon is a perfect example of how if you were a brick and mortar bookstore and you refused to do anything online, Amazon came and ate you as a company. So we saw it a little bit within some niches. What we're going to see is that if a company decides, no, AI is too scary, or I'm not prepared for this, or I can't do this, there's going to be a company that comes in that is willing to use AI and is going to be able to do everything that they can do cheaper, better, faster, better outcomes for customers, and they're going to eat those companies.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, on the topic of the fear factor, the first news item I have for the podcast today is about OpenAI, funnily enough, and the fact that they are being sued in the USA. Now, since the inception...
Copyright infringement.
Yeah. that's right. So since the inception of ChatGPT back in November 21... controversy has really never been very far away, and smaller legal battles have always been looming. However, at the end of June, a firm in California filed a class action lawsuit for stealing personal data in order to train ChatGPT with. And what's interesting about this case is that depending on how well prepared the complainants are, OpenAI may be required to fess up on how they trained that model. Now, it's something they've kept... pretty much a black box. The only public information about OpenAI or not so OpenAI's ChatGPT that we really know is that OpenAI scraped about 300 billion words from the internet. We don't know how they scraped them and where they scraped them from. Obviously, we believe, you know, Wikipedia and all that sort of stuff.
Let's be clear, and so we can neither Alistair nor I are barristers or lawyers or judges of any kind. However, most of that content is publicly available.
Yes.
There's an interesting wiggle in the lawsuit that says that some of it may have been pulled from behind a paywall that had a hole in it that somebody might have been able to get through. But the vast majority of that is publicly available, which, you know, brings up a whole bunch of conversations of...
That's right.
if I'm an artist and I go sit in the Louvre and I study the masters,
the Louvre, not the Louvre, by the way.
Yes, I know. And I study, oh, there might be masters in there too. And I study the masters and then I go paint a painting in the style of Rembrandt or Leonardo da Vinci and I sell that as my own work. Have I plagiarized their work?
Yeah. I guess the question is, have you stipulated that you've done it in the style of Rembrandt and ripped off? That's the interesting thing. So the complainant goes on to state that AI, OpenAI, did this in secret and didn't register as a data broker, which is also interesting, as well as they are required apparently to do that under applicable laws. So if you remember quite some years ago now, Facebook, where they sold your information out to data brokers, and they, like Cambridge Analytica, for example, and that was really murky. They didn't actually, neither party fully
disclosed
that.
Now it's in their terms and conditions.
Yeah.
I know, Alistair, the security guy you are, I know you have actually read most of those terms and conditions. I have gone through the cliff notes of them. And yes, it is in there now that if you use Facebook and you openly post on Facebook, that they are informing you that they will be selling your data to data brokers.
Yeah, basically they own your data. Anything that you give to them is their property. So, I mean, the most interesting aspect for me is how much OpenAI are profiting from these sources, or whether, in fact, they are profiting at all. It wasn't that long ago that OpenAI had stated that they do not yet turn a profit. Certainly on paper, OpenAI may be worth many billions in unrealized value. And recently, Microsoft made a $100 billion stake in the company. So it might have turned them into a profit-making machine recently, but it's still unclear.
Yeah, it's the number of companies, the number of applications that have registered using the OpenAI GPT-4, 3.5 or 4 APIs to then front in their own applications, or even ChatGPT's API. They may actually be making money now, but I've seen the numbers behind how they run their models and the amount of compute that they're having. They're consuming almost every compute that they can get from Microsoft to run them. And it's costing them a massive amount. In fact, I believe the CEO has said that they can't make the models larger than GPT-4 on the current technology platforms. I believe he did in an interview, Sam Altman said that he couldn't get any bigger. The compute requirements were too great. And in fact, GPT-4 is not actually one model.
Yeah, it's a multitude of smaller models, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the 15 counts in the complaints had were included privacy violations, negligence in failing to protect personal information, as well as, get this one, larceny by obtaining large amounts of personal data to train its models by illegal means. The lawsuit has stretched as far as to seek injunctive relief in the form of temporary freezes on commercial use of OpenAI's products. Now, if this was granted, it would have vast-reaching effects on organizations that currently use OpenAI's model on their own applications or services. So I'd say, Sean, it'd be quite unlikely that that would be passed, the temporary injunction.
It would be very difficult for them to justify look, U.S. law is U.S. law, and because it's a civil lawsuit, the judge can expect that there will be punitive damages within what the lawsuit is suing for. And so he might decide to do that, but I would find it, they would have to prove that there was ongoing harm like harm that is actually harming them, not harming their financial status, but actually harming the people in such a way before the judge would step in and grant that. But it's U.S. courts, so it's open to what
it's really interesting. So yes, going back to what you said as well about, you know, the content being free and open, freely available, you know, it is a very interesting question from a perspective of ethics. You know, certainly it's freely available, but on the other hand, it could be argued that people have a right to be guardians of their own content, and just because they put it up on the internet doesn't necessarily mean that it should be used in a wholesale manner by another corporation, potentially for profit.
Yeah, so, completely agree with you. And I think it's interesting because I believe it's a scaling issue, right? If someone had to go out there and manually get all those pictures and all those conversations and load them up, no one would probably care. But because it is just automatically done in the background by and there are some companies like Facebook and like Google that are making very large profits. I mean, you're talking top five companies market cap in the world.
Mm.
And based solely on your data and advertising dollars.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, if you think about it, Google, right till now, are the ultimate in that, because all they're doing is they've got an algorithm that sucked up all the content on the internet and presents it to a person on a search engine.
Yep.
And for that, they get ad revenue. So, you know, I guess if you're going to say have an issue morally with what OpenAI are doing, then why not the same for Google? So it's a very, very interesting
choice. It's going to be a very complicated, and let's be honest, if Microsoft is backing OpenAI, they're going to have a very high-priced lawyers that are probably going to tie this up in the courts for quite some time. But that kind of feeds into the next topic, right, which is regulation of AI. As we go forward, what we've been seeing doing it, and I know if you want to talk us through what's been happening within regulation.
Yeah. So, I mean, in China, for example, the market over there, it's the government, it happened a couple of weeks ago now, and it was making China one of the first countries in the world to do so. Now, there was bans, outright bans in countries like Italy, but this is actually a law. So this first draft of this law was fairly substantial in terms of its punitive measures, and we could see companies and individuals breaking the law fined up to 100,000 yuan. But the wording has been relaxed in very recent weeks to allow the development. So it's kind of like it was, you know, immediately, oh, AI bad, and now it's changed the wording to allow development of secure and trustworthy chips, software, and computing power. So key provisions.
The Chinese government has used AI for, you know, 10, 12 years as government agencies to do things of facial recognition, emotional analysis, even down to the point of they have cameras that watch kids in school, and if the kid isn't paying attention, even if they pass tests, they get marked down within the school. So I understand that. I think it's more a risk to the government is the aspect that they want to control within China's AI, not the reduction of development of it. Yeah.
And I think it's also because of the fact that generative AI is a concept which is, you know, we had separate AIs doing different things, but now we've kind of entered this new phase of wholesale AI, which will change the workload of the every person. And I think that's probably why they wanted to really push this law through. So they said that this new law is going into law on the 15th of August and require AI service providers to conduct routine, thorough security reviews, and all of their algorithms must be registered with the Beijing government. China wants to press ahead in the world of AI, but has lacked the freedom to do so from its government. So basically, companies like Baidu and Alibaba have not released any mainstream AI products, probably for the fear of reprisal, right? But it'll be certainly very interesting to see what comes out of China, see if this now either stifles innovation or allows the China to leapfrog the USA, which is actually what I think is they're wanting to happen here.
Yeah, I think what it's going to do is it's going to open up government coffers to help fund some stuff.
Mm.
And I think you're going to see a massive acceleration of AI that's already in existence. AI at universities, AI in companies. The ones you mentioned are, you know, Tencent and the big AI companies in China. We're suddenly going to see all of these Chinese products come to market that are AI based.
Yeah, I dare say that they've been developing all these products in the background, but been unable to press the green button until the government has said so. So
well, they're using them internally.
Yeah, exactly.
Which they learned. Okay, so they learned that from Amazon and from Google. So Google develops products internally, and then when they realize that it's good enough, good for them, then they sell it to the market. Amazon Web Services, the cloud, the entire AWS cloud was developed to run Amazon stuff on.
Yeah, I remember, and I was there. I don't know. Did I tell you that? I worked there around the time when there was no AWS, and all the AWS was a bunch of servers that ran horrible Perl scripts. And eventually, that somehow managed. There was a few provisioning tools that suddenly turned into EC2. So yeah, it was quite wild being there watching that happen.
And so that's China. In Europe, Europe has passed their AI framework, which is similar to GDPR. The U.S. government has had the Biden administration has had their AI, it wasn't a conference, it was like a focus group where they brought a whole bunch of AI people in to talk about it. And the government, the Senate and House are now looking at an AI framework that they want to pass. And even the United Nations has held a Security Council meeting, and there's a conference, a government conference supposed to happen in the UK later this year, all around AI. So
yeah,
look,
I was going to say, meanwhile in the UK they're still babbling on about a decryption of absolutely everything. So if you use encryption, i.e. that little padlock in your browser, that's bad, okay? And the UK government want to switch that off and read all your traffic. So this week, I think it was this week, Apple said to the UK government, they said, look, if you want to do this, we're out, didn't they? They said, but what was the technology they said they're not going to allow? I think it was FaceTime. I think they said, look, if you're going to impose this draconian security law, we are no longer going to allow FaceTime and iMessage in the UK.
Well, and even WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted, and Facebook has basically said that if the law goes forward, then I believe that they will pull, if you're coming from a UK, they'll region lock the UK so that you can't use WhatsApp.
Yeah. So, and I mean, like, and good on them. I mean, I think that's a good thing for them to say, look, hold on, this law is draconian. It is stupid. You know, human beings deserve a bit of privacy, and the internet is our current talking place. So we should be allowed to be talking in private.
And I understand the government's reaction is because, and by the way, we're going to have an entire security and AI episode. It will come soon. We're going to talk what AI means to security coming soon. But to touch on that just a little bit, the governments are running scared right now because the bad actors are wholesale using AI. I mean, like full on, the expect prints of Nigerian emails to start coming out again, only they're going to be written so well, you're going to think it's your grandma sending.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually got a really, really convincing email from IRD the other day. Like, the information it knew about me was pretty, pretty good. Now, the logos was there. I hovered over the link to log on to my IR and noticed that it was going to an IP address. If, you know, honestly, if it wasn't for that, I think, you know, I could see how that would be super easy to dupe people. So, I mean, it's top notch, and that will be AI based. I can guarantee.
Well, and because AI can write websites, like create websites on the fly, they don't have to pre-create it for, you know, 100,000 users. What they do is that when you click on it, it kicks off the AI that spins up the code. So you have your personalized website and you log your login details. I mean, look, the bad actors are using AI. There's a company out of the Ukraine, I think you and I were chatting about it, and I'm not going to put a link in the show notes. I don't want people going out and looking for it. But this company has gotten a hold of a large language model like ChatGPT that does code development as well. And for 60 euros a month, you can write viruses, scamware, and you can go out and do bad things with them.
So basically what they've done is they've taken the guardrails off. I understand actually that it is believed that they actually have the LLM from ChatGPT. I don't understand how they got it, if that is the case, but they have a large language model. And so it's basically what they've done is they've said, okay, those guardrails that OpenAI have, we're just taking them off now. And, and you know, you can ask it any naughty question you want and it will do what you ask.
So there was a hacker back in March that used the ChatGPT interface in a series of questions to basically rebuild the large language model outside of ChatGPT, which is which might be where the source came from. But the back to the regulation in the UK's, this is the UK having a knee-jerk reaction to, oh my God, we don't have AI. We're not using AI to regulate and protect people. We need them to open up everything they're doing because we need to see exactly what they're doing so we can get enough data so that we can start protecting the people. It's a bad reaction, but it is, I understand where it's coming from. I would say if I was talking with the UK government that one of the things that they might want to think about doing is they need to start investing in a strategic development of AI to protect UK citizens, not trying to put in a draconian law to rip out all security out of all communications running across. Well, the weird thing is it's not going to work because the bad actors have P2P VPNs.
Of course, of course. It's not going to make any difference. It's very ill-sided. Yeah. So switching gear just ever so slightly, still staying on the AI topic for now. And I promise not every show that we do is going to be AI related. It's just because this is how it turned out this month, I promise, or this week. So Elon Musk. Now I've grown to love just poking fun at this guy because I think he really has gone. I mean, talking about going off the wheels. This is this car is just sliding along the ground somehow.
He actually believes the things he says, which is he has nobody in his inner circle that's telling him when he's wrong. And so he truly believes everything he's saying now, and he gets it right often enough that he thinks he can get away with it.
Yeah. I just don't think the guy's getting enough sleep at the moment. And, you know, he thinks that, I mean, what do you think of the name of Twitter at the moment? The new name for Twitter.
The change. You know, it's funny because I noticed when Twitter updated on my phone, the icon now became the X.
Oh, yeah.
But when you shrink it down, when you're not selecting it, you shrink it down into a group, it's still the Twitter icon.
Ah, brilliant. So yeah, so before Twitter became X, about 2 weeks before that, Elon launched a new AI company, and it's called XAI. So everything's X, right? You could see where the branding was going. So
well, basically, and so interestingly enough, 3 months previous, Elon signed the letter to the government asking to stop all AI development.
He said, let's put a pause on AI because we need to, you know, things are getting too advanced too quickly.
Yep.
And we really need to, you know, put pause on this so that we can work out how the world is going to catch up to this. And look, it wasn't such a bad thing. I don't think that was a bad idea. And there was a lot of other people who also agreed with that statement. But then obviously, you, like I said earlier on in the podcast, you know, Pandora's box is open. There is no possible way to close it. You could close one company. You could say OpenAI, okay, you've got to press pause. But
the bad actors even if you could get everybody in the world that's doing legitimate development on AI to pause, that'll just give the time for the bad actors to get even farther ahead.
Yeah. So it would never work. And I knew that even when I heard it. I was just like, nah.
I think, you know, I don't know this, and Elon's probably going to cancel me for this, but I think he did it on purpose because he knew he was about to start his company and he wanted everybody else to pause while he started his company.
Look, the cynic in me would also agree with that statement, Sean, absolutely. But anyway, he started this XAI company. It's a team of around 12 engineers. He's keeping it nice and small. And I think, you know, honestly, I think that's what he's done with Twitter. Well, you could say it's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, small AI teams often seem to be the most successful ones. And so that sort of size of company is probably
good. Manages to successfully, because I mean, with his announcement of X, he also wants Twitter to become a platform like WeChat in China is, where it's a payments platform and it's a community and a business
platform. Everything platform, right?
If he manages to do that, I can see XAI rolling in as the AI portion of that X.
For sure. I think he should have just waited though. to get his X other stuff sorted out and then rebrand Twitter to X. So all his other X stuff, make that work, yeah. make it cool. And everybody's like, oh, have you heard about this X stuff? And then he goes, ha ha, X Twitter. You know, man, he's really stuffed it up.
His I'm going to remember that one. X Twitter. That's what we're going to call X Twitter.
That's it. It is RIP X Twitter. So yeah, but basically his mission statement on the website is definitely written by Elon himself. He says his mission is to understand the true nature of the universe. I don't know what he was smoking that particular day, but on the website it states that more information is coming in the following weeks and months. So aka, I haven't really figured this one out yet, but we'll smoke more pot and figure it out. It's going to be... So anyway, I don't expect
not
to see
New
anything.
Zealand. Not New Zealand. Alistair was not saying we're not smoking pot in New Zealand.
Not what we do. That I'm just talking about, you know, the X team in the United States, right?
I didn't want to get a call from NZ police asking me.
So I don't expect anything like OpenAI to come out of this for a good while. But you know, somebody who understands what generative AI is all about and sees its promise as well as its concerns, I think he's got the chops to do it realistically because he was one of the founders of OpenAI, if you don't, not to forget, right?
And now, remember his robot, the end of last year, the big announcement with his robot that they walked out on stage. And I remember I had the website for Boston Dynamics up and I was watching his robot on stage in Boston Dynamics. And I went, what? He's not even close to Boston Dynamics. I mean, Boston Dynamics has been doing, but Elon got everybody to talk about robots, and Boston Dynamics hadn't done that since the last time they made one do a backflip or something. And he got them talking, and he got investors investing in his company. And that's what Elon does really well is that he showcases the technology, even if it's not successful, even if he's throwing a giant ball bearing through the windshield of the Cybertruck. The next day, everybody's talking about the Cybertruck.
Yeah, yeah. Is that out yet? Is the Cybertruck out yet?
I read an article that said the first one had rolled off the production line in Texas, but I don't know.
What, down a cliff?
Who knows?
Yeah. So the website also goes on to say it is a standalone company, right? It's unrelated from Tesla and the other Musk companies, apparently. Which are now all called X Corps. However, Musk does state that he will closely work with the X Corps to put progress to the overall XAI mission. Now, from a privacy perspective, this does mean that it could be using tweets. And does that include DMs as the training model for XAI? It could be quite interesting. So watch the space.
Maybe only Elon's tweets. So it will only respond in an Elon way to...
Okay. So basically, you know, when I talk about garbage in, garbage out, Sean, you know, I'd ask, you know, how do I make, you know, and it'll come back Cybertruck. It won't make any sense. So yeah, sure. Why not? I'm happy with that. Now, just a couple other news items from me, and then I'll shut up, Sean. Talking about LLMs and the new ones, Bard, obviously, I mean, I guess it's not a new kid on the block anymore, but Google are quite weird in the way that they do the updates. Usually OpenAI, they're not big and showy about the updates, but Google are even quieter. They had their I.O. thing a while back, but they didn't mention anything about the ones that came out mid-July.
It's Google's really interesting, and I don't know if this was a marketing decision, but so Google has been using AI in their products. I mean, you and I know that they've been using AI in their search engine for years and years and years.
Yeah.
They've been using AI, but they have not, one, they have not branded any of their products. Two, they have not really talked about it openly in any kind of marketing. And then three, things like the Llama model that sits, or the Palm model that sits behind Bard, that's existed for years, and they have deliberately chosen not to release it to the public and have only released Bard to the public as a response to ChatGPT. I don't have any view into their marketing, but they may have looked at it and said, the general public aren't ready to accept AI and they're going to be a negative backlash. And so we're going to downplay all the AI. What I've seen in the last 3 or 4 months, though, is that I think they've realized that they've turned a corner.
Yeah.
And they're now touting all their AI stuff and everything they do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's fair enough. I mean, if I was Google, I'd be scared, and I'm pretty sure they are scared. So it's fair enough. But I am just surprised at how low key their marketing is. Now, the reason I say that is because they made an update on the 14th of July. And now if you go on your mobile, so the mobile website for Bard, won't work for a PC for obvious reasons when you hear what it does. But basically, you can now get it to accept images for its prompts. So you can just press the camera button and you can take a photo, for example, of your fridge and ask Bard to give you some recipes to rustle up. Now, I actually did this on the day it came out, and you know, it told me I could make a salad, and it works. Yes. You know, it was crazy. And I mean, I know that OpenAI were they've got that work coming out pretty soon as well. I mean, that was actually touted when GPT-4 was announced, but I haven't seen it in public yet.
They've deliberately paused it inside of the beta testing. It's been beta testing for a little bit, but they've paused the public public release of it for some other reasons. But absolutely. I mean, yes.
Yeah, it's cool. And then talking about, there's other two announcements. One is from Meta, or Facebook, as they used to be known. And that is that for commercial use, which is really interesting, for commercial use, Meta have launched open source AI model called Llama 2. Now, the first one was called Llama. I think it was closed to research only. This new model is competitive, says Zuck, with ChatGPT and Bard, and it's been trained with 40% more data than its previous model, Llama 1. So really interesting. I've got to check that. I haven't checked it out yet. Have you checked it out?
So I have. I've ran Llama 2. I ran Llama 1 previously with some other stuff. But
Llamas, I don't think they're very fast. They make a lot of noise as well.
Watch out, they spit. Llama 2 is significantly better than Llama 1. I think that as a large language model goes, it's comparable to ChatGPT and Bard. Like the input to output responses are on par with each other. What it's missing is it's missing the ChatGPT framework. So one of the things that ChatGPT does is it tokenizes your conversation, and so that it can hold information about. So if you go back and forth with ChatGPT through 3 or 4 different prompts to get you to where you're going, that's one of the things it does really well. The Llama 2 out of the box doesn't do that. You can enable it. There's a way to enable it, but you've got to have enough memory to do it. But it is the companies can take it and go build something with it, but they would have to build something. It's not like you could just go to a website and Llama 2 would just give you everything you needed.
Right. So it's really for, you know, more of the sort of researcher sort of in the uni sort of thing. Does the model download to your own machine and you build from there, or do you still work in the cloud on Azure or something?
So you can. I wouldn't recommend you doing it. It will crater your machine very quickly. I know somebody that managed to get a large language model running on their iPhone, and every time they turn it on, the phone reboots. I would not recommend, unless you have a very big GPU or a TPU card in your local machine, that you download and run a large language model locally.
Sure. All right. And then the final one is that OpenAI with ChatGPT, they released a new beta feature. I think that was a week or two ago, and it was called Code Interpreter. So if you pay for GPT Plus subscription, then you can switch this on. It's quite well hidden, actually. I had to look for a while to find out where it is. It's down in the bottom left. Anyway, with this Code Interpreter feature, you can give GPT a prompt. And with the interpreter switched on, it will know how to write and execute Python code. And it can also accept file uploads. So you can upload everything from Python code itself, but you can also upload, you know, Excel spreadsheets, CSVs, GIF files. Like I decided to ask it to animate a GIF, and it went off and did that. So it's extremely helpful for aspects of like data analysis. So image conversions, editing code files, all that sort of stuff, it can do that. And I think, you know, if you are a data analyst, that's your job, then it's going to be really interesting watching what their roles will look like in the future from this. Yeah.
But, yeah. So it's really interesting you bring this up, because I mean, Google has a product too that does the same exact thing. You just upload the data and you tell it what you want it to look for in English, and it goes through and interprets the data. But this is the result of Copilot. So Copilot has been running for about, it feels like 2 years, but I don't think it's been quite that long. It was in beta 2 years ago. But Copilot was OpenAI's integration with GitHub to be able to provide coding. So you could say, I want to do this, and it would help you write the code to do it. And it has gotten better and better and better and better. And the feedback from that training has now gotten to the point where we can actually have it write and run the code for us in the code interpreter. And it's if you're a software developer and you're not using these tools, Alistair and I were chatting online the other day about the, can we call it the demise of Stack Overflow?
The
graph of everything to do with Stack Overflow looks like it fell off a cliff.
Yeah.
Because these products work.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you want, especially in sort of fairly non-complex code, you say, you know, give it a couple of sentences, say, I want this to happen in this way, press return, pure normal English, then it's just written you an application. And you know, especially if it's Python or something like that, it's really crazy easy to do. So that's pretty scary stuff. OpenAI say now that the data that you provide, whether that be the spreadsheets or the images or the Python code or whatever it is that you ask for it to manipulate here or provide output for, they're saying now, though, that the data does not persist past the session that you have. Now, up until this point, it could have been assumed that everything that you provide Copilot and or ChatGPT was persistent, was something that I would take and use to train the model, right?
So even in ChatGPT, and up until about 2 months ago, and you had to be on Pro 2 months ago, but there was a setting you could go in where you could say, don't share my conversation sessions back into training.
Mm.
But that didn't exist 2 months, 3 months ago.
Yeah.
So I think that's, it's additional guardrails that OpenAI is trying to put on it. Take that for what it's worth. I know that I have very cynical friends that'll go, oh, they're just trying to do it to protect themselves. And I have very altruistic friends that will say, no, they're trying to do good things. I suspect that it's probably somewhere right down the middle.
Right in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. But
for sure.
But look, I know we've been really heavy on the AI, that, and it's only because AI has been in the news. We're going to talk about, you know, heavy into cybersecurity. We're going to talk about quantum computing. We're going to talk about, by the way, distributed ledgers, blockchain. There's a resurgence coming. There's a whole bunch of stuff happening. We've got some episodes coming up that, where we're going to cover these things. I want an entire, look, I'm asking Alistair, I'm going to out you right now. I want an entire episode on your new company.
Goodness.
I do.
Nobody wants to listen to that. Yeah.
I do. I want to hear about it. So we've got a whole bunch of stuff coming. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for bearing with us as we transitioned from season one to season two with Alistair and I's job changes. And we had to move all the technology, all the back episodes had to be moved. It was a lot to it. Yeah. I'm not making excuses. I'm just describing what had happened. We are committed to be doing these regularly going forward.
Yeah, I think the other thing that to point out is that when I listened back to the podcasts before the episodes, we had a really great mix of interaction. So we had guest speakers.
Yeah.
And we also had interaction through the socials, such as LinkedIn. People were wanting to hear specific topics be talked about.
Yep.
And I absolutely love that. And I know you do too, Sean.
Yeah. So, and that's a good point. We're going to bring some guests on. Alistair and I have already been talking with some people, and I'm going to out Kevin Johnson and say we're going to drag Kevin Johnson from Secure Ideas onto the podcast just because he's a good friend of mine. And I'm gonna call his wife Denise if he doesn't come onto the podcast.
Yeah, he's stuffed now.
but yeah, we want to bring guests on. This is not, I mean, look, Alistair and I could riff easily for 2 or 3 hours every week or so on these technology topics. They keep us awake at night. We really enjoy doing them, but we also want to get outside people's perspective on this. And the other is that Alistair and I both know that we're not as deep as some of these people are in some of those technologies. And it would be very good to get some deep expertise in to help us demystify some of
this. Yeah, I think as well, we're not just purely fixed around the technology. I mean, obviously, we're the technology whisperers, two bald guys riffing off about technology. But I think what I also love to hear is people's stories. And I think everybody loves a good story, don't they, Sean? And I think, you know, if you've got a story about how you ended up in technology or how you ended up doing this or that, we had Amanda Watson talking about, you know,
women in tech and
women in tech, and also, you know, how to get back into a role, not just the technology role, but I think it was a technology role in that particular example, how to get back into technology roles after being away for such a long period of time doing something else. So, it really is, there's lots of different stories that we'd love for you to share with us. So if you're interested, every single walk of life, every single background, you don't have to be overly technical. I would absolutely love to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no way to say it better than the way Alistair just said it. Please reach out to either Alistair or myself. We have gotten a producer. She's not going to be visible, but she might be fielding some emails and phone calls for us. But yeah, absolutely. Thank you guys very much for listening today. And you have a very, very good day.
Take care. Thanks for listening.